microgravity. What I want to deal with is the issue of covariance. And there's two different types of covariance that I want to distinguish here. The standard framework of Hamiltonian analysis of gravity breaks covariance in two ways. One, the first is the standard global covariance. What that means is general covariance is broken by a splitting of space-time into space plus time, the 3 plus 1 split. And in essence, these two, what that entails is that space-like and time-like diffeomorphisms are treated on different footing. And then there's a separate issue of local covariance. So this is very specific to the Einstein-Cartan theory of gravity. What that means is in the Einstein-Cartan theory of gravity, the local gauge group is the local Lorentz group, SO31. And in the standard framework, this is broken explicitly to a subgroup of rotations. So I want to address both of these issues in this talk. So classically, both these problems are usually not a problem at all. Global covariance, although it's not manifest, it's regained when you solve all the equations of motion. So it's really not too much of a problem. Local covariance, well, it usually doesn't play a significant role in the classical theory. When you're, say, evolving two black holes, the local covariance, you generally don't even use the Einstein-Cartan theory. Actually, I will show that there is a case in the classical theory where this really does matter. So the quantum problems. The local gauge group plays a major role in the quantum theory in the sense that, especially in loop quantum gravity, the local spin group is broken into SU2. And the discreteness of areas and volumes, so the paramount result of loop quantum gravity, is intimately related to the compactness of SU2. And there's some indications that in a more covariant theory, this is not going to work out. For example, in some of Laurent's work in 2 plus 1 gravity, there's some suggestion that I think it's space-like areas have a continuous spectrum and time-like have a discrete spectrum. There's an existing theory of covariant 3 plus 1 loop quantum gravity, and the spectrum of the areas doesn't appear to be discrete in that case. This is due to Sergei Alexandrov and Etro Levine primarily. And it's also known only at the kinematical level. So there's been a lot of people who've suggested that this result might not hold at a dynamical level, but only at a kinematical level. Okay. In addition to that, so this involves the local covariance. In addition to that, splitting of space-time manifests itself in the problem of time in quantum gravity. Okay. Essentially, what happens in the classical theory, there's a two-step program. First, what you do is you constrain yourself to the constraint submanifold. And then on that constraint submanifold, you have gauge orbits. And you have the freedom. You can either mod out by those gauge orbits, in which case you have a frozen time formalism, or you can just watch how the fields evolve along those gauge orbits. And that you really interpret as the evolution in time. But in quantum mechanics, those two steps are reduced to one. So once you solve the constraints, you've also effectively modded out by those gauge orbits. So you're stuck with this frozen time formalism. In addition to that, the Hamiltonian constraint plays a very different role than the other constraints. The diffeomorphism and the Gauss constraint, really all they are kinematical symmetries. They simply implement local SU2 invariants and three-dimensional diffeomorphism invariants. They don't do anything more. The Hamiltonian constraint, on the other hand, it tells you that the theory has to be invariant under time-like diffeomorphisms. But at the same time, when you solve this constraint, it gives you all the dynamical degrees of freedom, the local degrees of freedom. So they play a very different role. Okay, so the approach we're going to take, when faced with the problem of time, you can take two very different routes. And we've seen a lot in the conference, if you attended any of the talks. You can just simply take the problem at face value, and you can explore its consequences. In some extreme cases, Julian Barber was advocating that we get rid of time entirely in the framework itself. Or you could say, let's get rid of the canonical theory and let's simply do path integrals. Or we could say, we could guess that we're doing something wrong in the canonical theory, or simply that we're missing something. And there may be a better way of reformulating it such that we capture these notions. So what I want to do is adopt a sort of radically conservative view. So I want to retain as much of the canonical theory as possible. So what I want to do is I want to still talk about a symplectic form. I want to still talk about constraints, commutators, and so on and so forth. But I want to rework it in such a way that the issues are addressed. These covariance issues are addressed firsthand. And the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to try to perform the canonical analysis focusing instead of on the standard Hamiltonian phase space, I'm going to focus on this Lagrangian phase space, Lagrangian variables, functionals of the Lagrangian variables. And that contains this Hamiltonian phase space as a submanifold. And what I want to emphasize throughout is that this problem of covariance has consequences not only for the quantum theory, but also for the classical theory. Okay. So let's start with a very simple example. Here we have just a simple non-relativistic one-particle action. We have the kinetic energy minus potential energy. We're integrating from minus infinity up to the present time, t. So consider an arbitrary variation of this action. All right. Arbitrary variation splits into two pieces. One is this boundary piece. The boundary here is just the present surface. And a bulk piece, which gives you the bulk equations of motion. So the vanishing of this thing are Newton's equations. Okay. And this thing we're going to call the symplectic one form J. This I'm going to call the Lagrangian one form theta. Okay, so the symplectic one form is useful in the sense that if we think of delta as an exterior derivative on the phase space, taking the exterior derivative of J, again, so taking a second derivative of this, gives the standard symplectic form. So identifying mx dot with p gives us dx wedge dp, which is the standard symplectic form. Okay. Now, throughout this talk, what I'm going to do is focus on this Lagrangian one form. So I'm going to try to totally get rid of the symplectic one form and not mention it at all. The Lagrangian one form is useful. First of all, theta equals 0 gives you the bulk equations of motion. But from the general identity that the second exterior derivative of any function is equal to 0, we can see that delta theta is equal to negative delta j, which itself is a symplectic form. So you can get the symplectic form from theta itself. Okay? And it's useful for other things as well. Let's look at, consider a time translation vector field. So here our dynamical variables are x and x dot. Time translation vector field just looks like this, components x dot and x double dot. If we insert this into theta, okay, we get this. Integrating by parts, we get, well, this integral is effectively the work energy theorem. So you get 1 half mv squared plus v of x, which you interpret as the total Hamiltonian. Okay. So now, how do we write Hamilton's equations of motion? Well, typically, Hamilton's equations of motion look like this. You identify the time variable, well, you identify h with, you identify the time variable with the canonical vector field associated with the Hamiltonian. And this gives you Newton's equations. Now, let's rewrite that in terms of theta. We consider the Lie derivative of theta along t. The first term gives you the symplectic form contracted with t. The second term, well, this is the Hamiltonian itself. So these two things are equivalent. Hamilton's equations in this framework can simply be written as the time Lie derivative, the time derivative of theta is equal to 0. Okay. So the way to think about that, theta equals 0 carries the equations of motion, essentially. So what you want to do is progress the boundary forward in time in such a way that you contain, you retain all this information about the equations of motion. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, so I want to apply this general idea to a diffeomorphism invariant field theory. Okay? In particular, I want to apply it to Einstein-Cartan gravity. And the idea is actually, they apply very readily. So let's start with this full manifold is going to be called M star. And in M star, I'm going to embed a three-dimensional space-like hypersurface, which we identify with our initial data surface. Okay? The real manifold I'm interested in is this manifold plus everything in the past of it. So I'm just going to call that M, and the boundary of M is the space-like hypersurface itself. Okay? Okay, so a little bit on Einstein-Cartan theory. Dynamical variables are a spin 3-1 connection, the coefficients of the connection. Here I'm using this strange variable. I chose this variable because it looks like an omega, which technically is really a pi, but I'm just going to call it omega. I'm going to use a Clifford algebra notation, so this is the Lie algebra of SO3-1. And epsilon is a standard frame field, which I'll sometimes just call E. Okay. The Einstein-Cartan action, I'm just writing it like this. There's some wedge products in here, which I'm ignoring. But this is a standard Einstein-Cartan action. Okay. So the bulk equations of motion, when I vary with respect to omega, I get this thing, which I solve for the vanishing torsion. Vary with respect to E, I get Einstein-Cartan. These are the ordinary Einstein equations. Okay. Now, the boundary variables would be useful to separate out boundary variables from bulk variables. So what I'm calling just E is the pullback of epsilon. What I'm calling omega is the pullback of this thing, omega bar. Okay, pullback to the space-like hypersurface. That's just a matter of convenience here. Okay. So the symplectic form going through the standard construction, doing the variation, picking up the boundary term, is this. Okay, it looks like delta omega wedge delta EE. One key important property of this is that the symplectic form defined as such is degenerate. It's truly only a presymplectic form. And it's not because we've restricted to any solution submanifold. It's degenerate simply by construction. Okay? So the nice thing about focusing on theta as opposed to J is we can deal with this degenerate case very naturally. The Lagrangian one-form theta now is simply this. You can notice these two guys are the equations of motion, the vanishing of these two guys. Okay. And I'm going to define this concept of a Noether vector. A Noether vector is any vector W such that when I contract it with theta, I get a boundary functional. A functional on the space-like hypersurface alone. Okay? The reason I call it a Noether vector is because omega really does generate a bulk symmetry of the action. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I might have missed it. You may have said, did you make any assumptions about M star and this manifold you started with? I mean,
Nothing special except that it's R cross sigma.
Okay.
It's R cross. Yeah, I'm just restricting the topology.
Okay. And nothing in particular about sigma.
No. I mean, there may be some interesting issues there, but those are not the issues I'm going to focus on. So, okay, so there's three relevant Noether vectors. One is lambda. Now, these components are really the generators of the infinitesimal change in omega under a gauge transformation. These are the infinitesimal change in epsilon under a gauge transformation. So here, lambda is an element of the Lie algebra, spin 3-1. There's a Noether vector corresponding to spatial diffeomorphisms. Okay? And here, the idea is that n bar has to be space-like or tangent to the boundary. And then a Noether vector corresponding to time-like diffeomorphisms. Okay? Here, T is a time-like four-vector. Okay. So corresponding to each of those three vectors, we have three constraints. Simply insert them into theta. Inserting lambda into theta, we get the standard Gauss constraint. Okay? Except we haven't gauge fixed anything. Inserting n into theta, we get the standard three-dimensional diffeomorphism constraint. Okay? And inserting t into theta, we get the Hamilton, what I'm going to call the total Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian splits up into two pieces, what I'm calling the Hamiltonian constraint, plus a piece which is identical to this. Okay. The Hamiltonian constraint here, in this notation, the Hamiltonian constraint is truly a vector constraint. Okay. Effectively, you can think of it like it's repackaging the scalar Hamiltonian with the diffeomorphism constraint. But it's doing it in a covariant way. And here, lambda is just a contraction of, it's just the time component of omega. T is just the lift of the vector T into the fiber.
So here, CH of T is labeled by 4.
Yeah. Yeah, so T is really a 4 vector.
But they are not 4 independent from the other one.
No, they are independent. Okay, so if you choose a local frame, then you can show that some of these are, 3 of these are identical to this one. So if you choose a local frame. Okay, so yeah, in a sense that this is really repackaging the scalar constraint with the diffeomorphism constraint. Okay, so as before, I want to guess that the form of Hamiltonian's equations looks like this. Lead derivative along t of theta is equal to 0. And it actually does work out. The way to see that is, notice that the total Hamiltonian C is a function of Lagrange multipliers. Delta is the exterior derivative on the full Lagrangian phase space. So you can pick up 2 terms. One is just the ordinary derivative of C, holding lambda and t fixed. The other one is you're varying the Lagrange multipliers. So these things vanish separately because the left-hand side is independent of Lagrange multipliers. So we get 2 equations. One is the vanishing of the constraints. The other one is what I'm going to call Ham 2. It's the standard Hamiltonian equation of motion. Now, one key property of this, since omega is degenerate, so typically, if omega was non-degenerate, we could simply invert this and solve for t identically. Since omega is degenerate, we have this actually gives you something non-trivial. You can't simply invert omega. So basically, given any function x that's canonically dual to a vector field x bar in this sense, if there is an x such that this does hold, then simply insert a vector z such that omega z is equal to 0, so z is in the kernel, you can see that x has to be constant along z. So that's a restriction on the set of functions that you can actually identify canonical vector fields with. Okay. So what that means in this language, what we have is a full Lagrangian phase space. In that Lagrangian phase space, you can project out the Hamiltonian phase space. And this consists of a set of functionals that only depend on the boundary data, not on the bulk data. Okay. In the Hamiltonian phase space, there's 2 submanifolds. There's the ordinary submanifold, Ham1, where the constraints hold. But then there's a secondary submanifold, calling it Ham2, where there actually exists a canonical vector field associated with the Hamiltonian, which generically doesn't hold because omega is degenerate. Okay? So the true physical submanifold is the intersection of those 2. And does it actually work out? It does. The vanishing of the constraints are the pullback to the 2 surface of the Einstein-Cartan equations. The standard Hamiltonian equation is the pullback of the time components. So it does work out. So together, it gives you the full set of Einstein equations. Okay, so now let's look at the constraint algebra in this framework. So let's identify 2 separate vector fields, T1 and T2, and consider the commutator. The commutator is going to give you the lead derivative of commutator T1, T2 of epsilon. So it looks like this. Okay. So what I'm going to do is define this thing I'm going to call the theta bracket. Simply define the theta bracket to be contraction of the commutator with theta. Okay. And this bracket is, in some sense, a good bracket because It is anti-symmetric. It does satisfy the Jacobi identity, but it has a strange property that it's not Leibniz. So it won't have any derivative or matrix representation. But the nice thing about the theta bracket, first of all, by construction, if these two vectors, so I've written it down for T1 and T2, but I can insert any vectors in here. If the two vectors are what I've called Noether vectors, the bracket is closed by construction. The nice thing is theta is identically the Poisson bracket when Hamilton's equations hold. So when the lead derivative along T1 of theta is equal to 0 and along T2, since they're both good time coordinates, is equal to 0, then the two brackets are identical. Okay? All right, so now I want to talk about local covariance. So that's just the basic framework that I'm going to be working in. In particular, I want to talk about the retention of the local Lorentz group. We haven't made any restrictions on the Lorentz group. We haven't gauge fixed at all. Any questions so far? Yeah. Good question. I'm going to do that in the next step. Yeah, theta will change. The symplectic form won't change generically. I mean, if the total derivative doesn't contain other time derivatives, then it won't change. But theta will change. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so like I said, the nice thing about working with this theta bracket is by construction it's closed. You can see if I contract T1 and T2, it gives me a sum of the Hamiltonian constraint and the Gauss constraint with these coefficients. Okay, so it's identically closed. Gives me a closed algebra. And when I simply solve for these guys, it's a few pages of calculations, but it's simple. What I get is I find the total commutator. And the commutator of two Gauss constraints is another Gauss constraint. The remaining part, if I ignore this term, is just the Lie algebra of the de Sitter, anti-de Sitter group, or Poincaré group, where I've added a cosmological constant, together with this additional perturbation from the Weyl tensor. Okay? But I really want to talk about now this thing. You can see here the Lie algebra, or sorry, the constraint algebra reflects the Lie algebra. And it reflects exactly the SO31 Lie algebra. So we've really retained the full local Lorentz group.
Sorry, can you come in with more than last line?
Mm-hmm.
So what is this
equivalent gamma H? So if you reduce to appropriate submanifold, this is what you get.
So you get a CH on the right hand side?
No, generically. So there's a way of writing this which doesn't look like this at all. So then you have to restrict yourself to submanifold to make it look like this nice form. But it is, it's still close.
Because CH, as far as I understand, contains probably this diffeomorphism. Mm-hmm. So if I commute to diffeomorphism, I get back a diffeomorphism.
Yeah, so basically what's happening here, on a restricted set of solutions, diffeomorphisms can be equivalent to gauge transformations. And that's basically what's happening here. So for example, if you have a flat curvature, a diffeomorphism is always equivalent to a gauge transformation. In this case, it's equivalent to a de Sitter transformation plus a perturbation term. That's what's happening.
This formula is very in general. Because here, you have a non-shape tensor.
I have a what? Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what I want to look at is one simple consequence of retaining the full local Lorentz group. And there's been a lot of discussion in class, quantum mechanically, what happens when you do this. This is Sergei Alexandrov's work. What I want to look at now is a classical effect of this. Okay? So typically you think of, well, I can fix the gauge any way I want in the classical theory. It's not going to change anything. It may be simpler to solve for certain solutions in a particular gauge, but it doesn't really matter. But in fact, what I'm going to argue is that it does matter. So The way we're going to see this is let's restrict ourselves to configurations that are asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS, anti-de Sitter or de Sitter. Okay. When you do that, you have to add a boundary term to the action. Okay. In order to make the full action finite, you need to add a boundary term. Now, in first order framework, in the second order framework, you also have to add an infinite counter term, but I've shown recently that in the first order framework, this is good enough. Okay. So what happens when you add that boundary term, like you said, each of the constraints will pick up additional terms. Okay. The Hamiltonian constraint will pick up this additional term, and the Gauss constraint will pick up this additional term. Okay. So on the constraint manifold, you can see these guys vanish on the solution subsurface. So this is the constraint submanifold that we're interested in. These guys don't. Okay. And these guys really do generate asymptotic Poincaré transformations. So on that solution submanifold, we just look at this term. What we get is something finite. And this is truly, this is the ADM energy momentum written in this language. Okay. The PI is truly a four vector.
So just to go back to the fact that you say that in the first order formation, there's no infinite counter term to the end. So that means that there's no quantum movement.
I don't really know much about that, so I can't comment too much, but that's where it comes from, you're saying?
No, I'm saying it's an interesting statement because I'm surprised in the future.
They're writing down an action where, say, if you had ADS, all kinds of coordinate transformations would be considered gauged, but in the context of ADS CFT, you wouldn't think of them as gauged. Like some reparameterization of the regular coordinate you think of as a different choice of conformal frame. That would be gauge, I think, whereas in ADS CFT, it wouldn't. So you're talking about two theories with different redundancies.
Okay. So conformal symmetry street is an exact symmetry. Maybe it's another discussion.
Yeah.
If you're not choosing that, because it's kind of surprising. Because, as you say, there's one symmetry in the body, which is like, you know, rather different morphism that does have an impact.
Well, it may change in ADS. It was worked out in the case of asymptotically flat spacetimes that you don't have to have the infinite boundary term. I really actually don't know if it works in ADS. Okay. So the question now we want to ask is a very simple question, which should have an answer. What happens when a spinner, say a neutrino, falls into a black hole? In particular, what happens to the spin? Since the neutrino fell into the black hole, you can't extract any information from the field itself. But if you're sitting at asymptotic infinity, well, the spin should somehow be conserved. So in that sense, the spin, well, since the neutrino doesn't really couple to the electromagnetic field, the spin should itself be encoded in the gravitational field, okay? Which is a very strange statement because half integral spin is generally only associated with fermions, and gravitational field is typically thought to be purely bosonic. But what I want to argue is that the gravitational field actually does encode the spin, and you can see that asymptotic infinity. So let's look at the boundary term that came from the Gauss constraint. This boundary term looks like this, sigma ij. Okay? It's a very simple operator. Or sorry, a very simple expression. It just looks like sort of the integral of area 2 form over the 2 surface, which we're taking to be the 2 sphere S2. Okay. yeah.
In de Sitter space, where's
Well, I'm being kind of loose about that. I haven't thought too much about it, but the basic idea is in, say, static slicing, you want the boundary to be at the horizon, say, and you want your space-times to approach the sitter as fast enough that as you approach the horizon, it looks like the sitter. That's the basic idea. really, when I'm dealing with this, I'm really just going to talk about the asymptotically flat case. It may be, you may be able to apply it to the sitter case. Okay? Okay, so now on the constraint subspace, on the solutions to the equations of motion, the algebra of the boundary terms is non-trivial, and it gives you precisely the ADS or Poincaré algebra. Okay? So there are no, there is no perturbation from the Weyl term because the Weyl term is assumed to fall off line 1 over well, seem to fall off fast enough that it doesn't contribute. Okay. In particular, the sigma still satisfies the SO31 Lie algebra, just like a spin operator should. So the idea is we want to interpret sigma ij as precisely a spin generator of local spin angular momentum to distinguish it from orbital angular momentum, which effectively comes from this term. Okay. Because the algebra, let's take lambda equal to 0. Because the algebra is a Poincaré algebra, what we want to consider is the invariants of the algebra. There's two invariants for the Poincaré algebra. One is this C1, the first Casimir, which ends up being just the ADM mass. It's the square of the four momentum. Okay. The remaining one, though, is Quartet-Casimir, or the spin invariant. It's if we square this field wi, wi, where wi ends up being this thing, where j is the total angular momentum, which includes orbital plus spin angular momentum, and it involves the momentum. That's a key point. Okay. And generically, the Quartet-Casimir has eigenvalues m squared, which is this eigenvalue, times s plus 1, where s takes on half integer values. Okay. Okay, so what is this Quartet-Casimir? Well, there's another way of writing it. C2 is equal to C1, it's just this piece, times the sort of the norm of the spin operator, sigma tilde, where sigma tilde is the perpendicular projection of sigma into the components perpendicular to the momentum. Okay? So in some sense, it's really the three-dimensional spin, but the three-dimensional subsurface you're picking out is the one perpendicular to the four momentum. Okay? So you can calculate this, and not surprisingly, for a Schwarzschild black hole, it gives you 0. Incidentally, the Sij are not 0. Just when you compute the Quartet-Casimir, it does give you 0. And maybe a little bit more surprisingly, you can compute it for the Kurt solution as well, and it does give you 0, which tells you that, one thing I didn't mention, the orbital angular momentum doesn't contribute at all to this Casimir invariance, only the spin angular momentum. So given that it's 0 for Kerr, it tells you that this thing, if it's really spin, it's not orbital angular momentum. Okay. And the reason why it works is because torsion couples to the axial current. And when you work it out, the axial current is directly related to this spin operator sigma ij. Okay. So you can do a Komar-type integral where you sort of average the axial current over the three manifold, identifying that axial current with the torsion, you can turn that into a total derivative. That total derivative gives you a boundary term, which is precisely the spin operator Sij. So the reason it really works out is the coupling to torsion. So you can't see it in a second order framework. Okay? The other thing I wanted to stress, though, here is that the covariance is really necessary. And the reason is because I'm projecting out this three-dimensional sub-spin space, a three-dimensional vector space. Okay, and the projection is the components perpendicular to P. But P is not given to you beforehand. Right? P is not a fixed vector. It's a dynamical vector. So you have to calculate it. So you can't simply gauge fix and hope to get the spin operator. You really have to do it in the covariant framework. So what's happening here is Well, so basically, what you thought was gauge fixing is not really gauge fixing, because in the asymptotically flat case, these gauge degrees of freedom are true degrees of freedom. So if you fix the gauge, you're really killing true degrees of freedom on the boundary. Okay.
So, I'm not sure I've been for a bit. It was like the previous question, rather than when a spinning object falls into a black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that you're kind of creating torsion outside the black hole?
No. So what's happening is the torsion is, you can assume that the spin field is has support only on a compact region. If you do the average over that compact region, you can turn that integral into a boundary term. And then I can push the boundary out to asymptotic infinity. And the remnant of that information is still encoded in the gravitational field. That's the idea.
But you were saying, not only the gravitational field, the torsion part.
No, it won't, because it's really just.
I missed. What is the role of the torsion here? What is the torsion?
Right. So this expression, if I put a d in here and integrate it over the free surface, the d would give me the torsion, but the d also gives me the total derivative, which gives me the boundary term. So this expression doesn't have torsion in it at all, but the remnants of torsion in the interior does affect the geometry on the outer boundary. That's the idea. I mean, it's the same thing as any Komar integral. You're integrating something that's basically zero everywhere except at the singularity, but you want to try to avoid talking about integrating over the singularity.
And by the boundary sigma here, when you say asymptotic infinity, it really means something like spatial infinity.
Yeah, spatial infinity, yeah. Okay, any questions on that? And I could say more on that, but I'm going to skip that. It turns out this might have very interesting consequences in the quantum theory, precisely because the spin generates large gauge transformations. But I'm going to skip that. Okay, so now I promise you I want to talk about global covariance. Okay, so we talked a little bit about local covariance. Global covariance, in particular, what I want to address is the issue of discrepancy between space-like and time-like diffeomorphisms. Okay. So I'm going to use the framework of geometric quantization. So what I want to do is adopt the basic idea, the standard procedure of geometric quantization, but as I did in the first part of this talk, focus on the Lagrangian as opposed to the symplectic one form. Okay. And the wave function will be a functional of the Lagrangian variables, which include this, which includes this Hamiltonian phase space as a submanifold. And so the basic idea of geometric quantization, what you do is you introduce a complex line bundle over the Hamiltonian phase space. The pre-quantum wave function is a section of this bundle, so it's really just a complex function of all the Hamiltonian variables, p and q. Okay. And then you identify, the standard idea is to identify symplectic one form with a U1 connection on this bundle. Okay. So I want to do the same thing, except now I'm going to introduce a complex line bundle over the Lagrangian phase space. Pre-quantum wave function is a function of Lagrangian variables, okay, which contains the boundary information. And the Lagrangian one form now becomes the U1 connection. So let me show you what I mean. So let's look at a general symplectomorphism. So a symplectomorphism is just a diffeomorphism on the phase space that preserves the symplectic form. So the lead derivative along x has to equal 0. So given that, omega is closed, so you just have this expression. That means that at least locally, you can associate a function x with a vector field, where x bar is a generator of the symplectomorphism. Okay. So under that same diffeomorphism, what happens to j? Well, j goes to j plus its lead derivative. But I can re-identify that using this identity. with J minus delta phi some phase, which looks like this. Okay? But the key point is what was a diffeomorphism now became what looks like a U1 transformation. Okay? And I can do the same thing for theta. Nothing really changes. Okay? So the key is what looked like a diffeomorphism on J looks like a U1 transformation. So we identified J with a U1 connection coefficient. The curvature of J, of this connection J, is I times the symplectic form. But I can do the same thing. There's nothing stopping me from doing that with theta. I mean, by this identity, the curvature of theta is equal to I times symplectic form. The only strange thing is that here, this curvature is non-zero everywhere. This curvature has support only on this Hamiltonian submanifold, which is sort of strange, but let's deal with that. Okay, so the real difference here in the J representation psi is a function of the pullback fields, omega and E. These are the boundary, the pullback of the dynamical fields to the boundary. Over here, it's a function of these true Lagrangian variables defined over the full Lagrangian phase space. Okay. So there was this duality, a symplectomorphism looked like a diffeomorphism, had this dual role of diffeomorphism and a U1 transformation. This field psi transforms in both ways. It's a combination of a U1 transformation and a diffeomorphism. So infinitesimally, it looks like here's your infinitesimal U1 transformation, here's your infinitesimal diffeomorphism. Okay? Total, the combination of these two things, we call the pre-quantum operator. But I could do the same thing over here in the theta formalism. Nothing changes, okay? At least formally. So the pre-quantum operator looks like this. It's I times the insertion of y into the covariant, the U1 covariant derivative minus the function itself. So I mixed up y and x here. Just put the x and y in this. Questions so far in this? Okay. So the key property of this is that, first of all, there's a unique, in the case where the symplectic form is non-degenerate, there's a unique pairing between a function, an observable, and a pre-quantum operator. Okay. When it's degenerate, like in our case, there's an almost unique representation. And the bracket algebra, the commutator algebra, sorry, the operator algebra, is a reflection simply of the Poisson bracket, the Poisson algebra. Okay? The Poisson algebra and the associated Lie algebra. Okay? And the same works out, obviously, in the theta representation.
But this is a
reducible
representation. What's
that? That's a reducible. Yeah. Right. So that's the second part. So there's this unique pairing between observables and pre-quantum operators, but that's obviously not enough in quantum mechanics. There's no unique map between the two. You have to introduce polarization. So that's the really non-trivial part of this. I'm going to sidestep that a little bit. Let's see why. Okay, so an example, Gauss constraint. Here's the dynamical vector field associated with the Gauss constraint. The operator is very simple. This really is just I times the Lie derivative along the vector field, lambda. Okay. Same thing over here, lambda. The only difference, of course, is lambda is defined over all of M. Four-dimensional manifold containing the boundary. Okay. And I can work it out. Gives me the same type of thing. Okay. So this is an example of what I'm going to call a kinematical constraint. The pre-quantum constraint, all it does is implement this kinematical symmetry. So it just tells me that the Lie derivative along psi of lambda is equal to zero, which is simply the statement that psi is gauge invariant. Okay? doesn't do anything more. Same is true of the diffeomorphism constraint. It's kinematical. The key property, though, is that these kinematical operators, if it's kinematical before you introduce a polarization, you can always find a U1 gauge where it's kinematical after the quantization. Well, so it's a stronger statement, actually. All kinematical operators, given the full set of kinematical operators before polarization, that same set, you can always find a U1 gauge where that full set is kinematical after quantization. It's one of these where the operator is just the lead derivative. Okay. The really nice thing about this, we know this kinematical Hilbert space gives us generic properties of quantum geometry, which are they're separated from the complicated dynamics. It just tells you generically what quantum geometry looks like when you impose local, say, SU2 invariants or diffeomorphism invariants. Okay? So, for example, in loop quantum gravity, kinematical Hilbert space is what we really know. This is the rigorous and unique Hilbert space. And we say that discreteness of quantum geometry really is seen in this kinematical Hilbert space. Okay. So let's look at the total Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. In the J representation, we have the vector field corresponding to time-like diffeomorphisms is this, associated with the total Hamiltonian. You look at the quantum operator, and it's not kinematical, as you should expect, right? So this extra term looks sort of innocuous, but when you try to implement a polarization, this is where all hell breaks loose, basically. But in this theta representation, let's look at the same type of thing. In the theta representation, I do the same contraction, calculate the pre-quantum operator, and it is precisely kinematical. Okay? And what this really comes down to is that the total Hamiltonian can be written as a contraction of theta with the vector field. Okay? So it looks like we have a kinematical representation of the total Hamiltonian.
Okay. So in this representation, at some point you mentioned that it exists only in the supported shell.
The what?
Right, you were saying that
yeah.
Solution, so
right.
The wave?
No, the wave function, at least in this picture, is going to be defined over this full four-dimensional space with boundary manifolds. So, yeah, the wave function is really a function of this whole thing.
But you don't have
going down to.
Condition?
What's that?
You don't have this on-shell condition.
I mean, you mentioned, you said
there wasn't any on-shell condition. It was
okay,
just
so
that the curvature of the connection theta has support only on the Hamiltonian framework, Hamiltonian
so,
phase space.
So what happened?
But that's not. It's
so
not
the
really.
The curvature is like the symplectic structure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm outside, it's zero.
Yeah.
Which does it mean in terms of this pre-quantum operator?
Basically, what it means is that, I'm going to get to that. But basically, what it means is that we haven't implemented dynamics, which is obvious because we have kinematical operator. The dynamics is really going to be implemented by constraining everything else. So, all we've said, all the symplectic form here, because it's non-zero everywhere except on the boundary, it only tells you something about the wave function here. To implement the dynamics, you have to constrain the wave function in here. And at least this framework doesn't give you that yet. But it does give you this very nice property.
Okay. But where does the necessity to impose the dynamics come from? I mean, here, the way you tell the story, it seems that.
Well, so that was my next point. So here's the intuitive way of thinking about it. In the J representation, basically in this frozen time framework, what you're imposing is the information that holds for all time on the wave function on one spatial slice. But here in the theta representation, we have information on the spatial slice, but all the other information as well. And what you're imposing when you implement these pre-quantum operators is only a limited set of information, but it's precisely the kinematical information that you want. The dynamical information we haven't said anything about yet. So that's sort of hand waving, but okay.
At which stage do you see the necessity to look for the dynamics? I mean, the usual framework, it comes from consistency of the area. So here, at which stage do you?
I guess I don't know.
Maybe you want to go from this pre-quantum representation.
Yeah, I don't know. At some point, when you push this theory, you're going to have to face the problem that this doesn't have dynamics. I don't know where you're going to face that problem. I mean, if it's you go all the way to the level where you look for semi-classical solutions and you find that they're not GR, I don't know. It's probably going to happen before that, but I don't really know.
Maybe because you're still at this pre-quantum level.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe. But like I said, when you implement a polarization, the kinematical operators are preserved. So I'm not convinced. The next section, though, I'm going to show you what I think is a solution or a potential solution. And I'd really like to get to this. What do you guys want to leave? Or it is pub night. Okay, good. So you guys are stuck. Okay, so the advantage is we can separate the kinematics from the dynamics, at least in the simple case. So it could be possible, and this is a bold statement, so take it with a grain of salt. The problem of time is no worse here than the problem of space. The problem of space is obviously non-trivial. It's really the problem of coming up with a semi-classical limit. But it's a beast of a totally different nature than the problem of time. And we've seen that the kinematical Hilbert space does give you very generic properties of a quantum space-time geometry. So it's very nice. Disadvantage, we have to find some other way of imposing dynamics. So here's the problem. Symplectic form was only defined on the Hamiltonian phase space. It only has support on the Hamiltonian phase space. It's zero everywhere else. Can we actually smoothly extend the symplectic form to the four-dimensional manifold? What I'd like to suggest is maybe we can. Split up theta into two parts, omega and an e part. Omega is this one. Vanishing of this gives you one part of the equations of motion. Vanishing of this gives you the other part. Okay, let's focus on this one. If I take the exterior derivative of this guy, it gives me a two-form on the full four-manifold. Integrating by parts, I get a boundary piece, which is precisely the symplectic form on the boundary, the standard symplectic form, plus this other piece, which is defined in the bulk of the manifold. Okay, so for now, let's just forget about this. I'm curious about this thing. What happens in the bulk? Okay. So to find this 4D is a presymplectic. It's highly degenerate. Presymplectic form, ignoring the boundary. So just look at this piece. Okay. Now, this has very strange properties. It's not a standard symplectic form, presymplectic form. Precisely because if you look at this expression, the pullback of this form to the solution manifold is identically zero, which means if I contract omega with any vector tangent to the solution space, it's identically zero. Okay. But let's see what we can get from it. Okay. So let's look at the constraints. Let's look at four-dimensional diffeomorphism, so purely four-dimensional. And spin 3-1 gauge transformations, local Lorentz transformation. Okay, so the two vector fields associated with these transformations are these guys. Here, V can be space-like, can be time-like, or any linear combination thereof. Okay. So contract that onto omega, and I do get the derivative of a boundary function, which means that symplectic form, well, these things really do generate symplectomorphisms. Okay. And what are those constraints? Those constraints are these guys. Most important thing to notice is that they do vanish on the appropriate submanifold, because the vanishing of this is the one of the Einstein-Cartan equations that's equal to the vanishing of this, which is the other one. So they do vanish. They really do. I mean, this is not the full set of constraints, but they do vanish on the appropriate submanifolds. Okay. I can go through and do the constraint algebra. The algebra is very trivial. You just work it out. And it reduces to, it's a realization of the Lie algebra of the full diffeomorphism group, the full group of gauge transformations. SO31 semi-direct product with four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. Okay. So if we can make sense of this, the theory has four-dimensional diffeomorphisms and this full local Lorentz group built into it from the very beginning. Okay. And you can go through the same procedure to find the pre-quantum operators, and they are kinematical operators, as before. Now, I should say that there's problems associated with this model that come down to effectively this. So I don't know if this is the right thing, but at least gives us some hope that we can do this. But the key point is, what we've done is we've been able to define what looks like a symplectic form, what looks like constraints, what looks like a constraint algebra on the four-dimensional Lagrangian phase space, not simply on a hypersurface. Okay. So it gives us hope that we can do canonical quantum gravity in four dimensions, not simply on a hypersurface. Okay. And so just conclusions. I wanted to stress that a lot still can be done at a fundamental level to address these issues of local and global covariance. And addressing these issues in a satisfactory way is going to give you insight both in the classical and the quantum theory. Okay, so we saw two examples of that. And one doesn't have to give canonical theory. You don't have to necessarily go to a path integral formalism to retain covariance. And in light of Julian Barber's talk, I just want to mention you don't have to throw away time. Okay. So, questions?
As you say, what you're doing here is you're extending the whole Hamiltonian framework in some sense, of this covariant space. Not imposing the solution. So at some point you mentioned that this symplectic for mass, this non-vector, which is essentially the equations of motion.
Yeah.
So the idea was that now you have this fully combined framework, which doesn't use slicing or the notion of space-time decomposition. Yeah. Then somehow what was before the equations of motion, usually if I have a symplectic form and I have a null vector, it's associated to a symmetry.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
This case is going to be something else.
Yeah.
The necessity of imposing the dynamics is that you have this, this full symplectic structure is redundant, right? Unless you really impose this equation of motion or there's a gauge symmetry flow associated to it. Do you understand?
Sort of. That's why I mentioned there are these problems. So,
is it a problem?
I don't know if it's a problem or not. I mean, we can certainly identify. I mean, normally you identify the constraint submanifold by imposing constraints. That's not going to happen here. you can identify the constraint submanifold, and it's precisely the submanifold or the pullback of the maximal submanifold where the pullback of omega is precisely zero. So it's going to be very different than the standard symplectic framework.
Oh, instead, okay, what you're saying is that this symplectic such form as a kind of a rank which changes from where you on where you are, the rank of this object is varying, and it's like minimal on the constraint surface.
Yeah, I think that's probably the statement. Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, my point is, it's not going to look like the standard structure. You're not going to solve for the solution submanifold by imposing constraints. You're going to do it some other geometric way. But the point is that the solution submanifold is, in some sense, a very special submanifold still on this space. So. Go ahead.
Your claim that fixing the internal gauge, you might lose actually physical degrees of freedom. Was it related to the presence of spinners, or it might be more general?
What do you mean by more general?
Even in the absence of spinners. So even in vacuum or just...
Well, in the quantum theory, yeah. In vacuum, in the quantum theory, definitely will give you implications whether you couple spinners to it or not. Classically, I don't really know. Yeah, I don't really know.
So you're doing these things for gravity, but are you trying to do this kind of polarization of this way much simpler model
So this last couple slides, I don't see any obvious way of getting something like this on a general framework. I mean, the fact that you can write this down is somewhat specific to Einstein-Cartan theory, so I'm not really sure. The remaining part, defining theta and all this other stuff, that you can all do. But the last couple of slides, I don't know if you can do generally. But this framework is very much overkill unless you have a diffeomorphism invariant theory.
Not